This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Joined right now on Hope 103.2 by Dr. John Dixon. He is speaker, he's an author, he's an historian. Two brand new books out called The Doubter's Guide to the Bible and the Ten Commandments. Thanks for joining us, John.
Hey, always good to talk to you guys.
John, listen, we've got a couple of deal breakers that we often come up with in conversation, maybe with friends or maybe in the schoolyard, and I'm hoping that you can give us some wisdom on it.
I'm willing to give it a go.
Okay, so the first question that often gets asked is, science and God are opposed, or does evolution actually disprove the theory of creation? How would you answer that, mate?
Look, I think with any question that's asked, you have to concede that there's something to it. You know, like, sometimes Christians have been a bit anti-science, and I always think to respond with a bit of honesty is important. But in terms of the actual issues, I'm of the view that Christians can disagree over evolution. You know, sensible, godly, Bible-believing Christians have different views on that. But in terms of the science God thing, I reckon it's a lot clearer. Science only strengthens our belief in God for the simple reason that the more science discovers, the more it is clear that our universe is not accidental. It is rationally ordered, that the elegant mathematics work at the tiniest level right out to the, you know, massive universal level. And that is the principal argument for God's existence that philosophers have employed for years. It's precisely because we live in a rational, ordered universe that there must be a rational mind behind it. In other words, every time science discovers how something works, what they're actually discovering is how our universe is beautifully, elegantly, mathematically ordered. That just points to God. Right. Every scientific discovery that's a real discovery, Christians ought to be able to say, fantastic, more of God's wisdom is discovered.
I think kind of macro-micro here. So on a macro level, you might be able to witness that. But on a micro level, isn't faith just irrational and emotive, and there's not really much evidence to back up the Bible?
Well, that's one way people use the word faith. I think it's an unfortunate way. The Oxford English Dictionary, which is usually the authority on, you know, that language that we speak, defines faith as a belief based on evidence, testimony, or authority. In other words, faith isn't the opposite of evidence and testimony. Faith is reasoned. It's based on good evidence. But obviously, when you trust something or someone, not every aspect of your trust is proven. You might have good reasons to trust someone, and that's enough to sort of, you know, put your faith in them. So, I mean, we're exercising faith every time we walk into a doctor's surgery, you know, and trust them with our well-being. What we're doing is we're trusting that they are an authority, that they've got the documentation, and so on. And I think Christianity's got a great deal of evidence to support it, biblical, philosophical, and so on. Not proof, but enough evidence for someone to express trust in this as a reasonable way of understanding the world.
Okay. So along that idea of trust, you know, and you say that God is living, he's active, he's participating in all our lives. If God is real, then why is there so much suffering and hardship and persecution that we see going on around us?
Look, I mean, this is the age-old question, and I don't think anyone should rush too quickly to sort of, you know, defend God on this, you know, because if someone's actually experienced suffering, it doesn't matter how philosophically tight our answer, it's going to seem irrelevant. I mean, philosophers long ago came to the agreement that suffering doesn't disprove the existence of God, because in order to use suffering to disprove God, you'd first have to show that God couldn't have good reasons for allowing suffering to continue. And until you can prove that he doesn't have good reasons, you can't use suffering as proof that he doesn't exist. Now, philosophers are pretty much in agreement on that one, but that doesn't help someone who's really going through suffering. And so this is where I think the Christian faith has a wonderful, utterly unique approach, because it says two things, really. Even if we can't explain why you're suffering right in this moment, God has promised a wonderful future where he's going to resolve the pain. So there's hope. There's a reason to get up out of bed. There's a reason to look forward to God's good future where he's going to make everything right. And the second thing the Bible says is that God hasn't just left it to the future. He's entered into history. He's suffered injustice and insult and betrayal of friends and ultimately torture, agony, and a final breath on the cross. So the God we bring our questions to is a God who himself has wounds. And that's something no other tradition, no philosophy, no religion can offer. A God who understands our pain because he's close, because he's experienced it.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's good. A question a lot. If God is so good, you know, following Christ is so fantastic, then why are Christians such a bunch of self-righteous hypocrites?
Because sometimes we are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just a reality. And at the Center for Public Christianity, we're doing a documentary, you may have heard, about the best and worst of the Christian faith. And there's nothing like, you know, being a student of history to realize that there are a lot of bodies buried out there in Christian history. So I think we can, again, acknowledge that there is something to this. Christians have been self-righteous. They've been hypocrites. Mm. The thing that I keep coming back to, though, is that Jesus wrote a beautiful tune, and just about everyone agrees with this. His tune was, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, and he took it all the way to the cross, where he loved his enemies and gave himself for us. And Christians have sometimes sung that tune beautifully, in tune. Mm. Sometimes they've sung it very poorly. But we all know to distinguish between the beautiful composition and the pretty awful performance. You don't blame the composition just because the performance sort of ruins it. Mm. We've got to understand that there's a musical score that Jesus brought into the world, and Christians have sometimes sung it well, sometimes not. But I guess the challenge for anyone who believes is to make sure you're singing the tune of Jesus.
Mm, that's good. Man, we've pushed in. My walls are starting to come down, okay? It's starting to unravel. This Jesus guy is starting to make a lot of sense. So I'm going to throw you my ultimate defense. Here it is. What is good for you does not necessarily have to be good for me, because truth is relative. So that's fantastic for you, John, but I don't need that Jesus in my life. I can follow a different truth and a different path.
Yeah. People say it like it's something we invented, you know, recently at a party over a glass of Chardonnay. But it's a really old idea. It goes right back to the 5th century BC with a philosopher called Protagoras. And he's the guy who said, things are for every man what they seem to him to be. In other words, you know, what's true for you is true for you. It doesn't have to be true for me. But in the next century, Plato pointed out that the statement is kind of illogical, because if it's true that things are only relative, does that include Protagoras' idea that things are relative? In other words, you know, if Protagoras' claim is true, it proves that it's false, because he's claiming one truth, that everything's relative. So you can actually tie yourself up in a completely self-contradictory idea. As soon as people say there's no such thing as genuine truth, you ask, is that a genuine truth? Mm. The statement you just made. The reality is, we don't apply this way of thinking to anything other than religion and ethics and those really important issues. Because in normal life, either something is true or it isn't true. Mm. You know, and some answers, like math, some answers can be a little bit closer to the true answer, but answers are either true or they're false. And, you know, so I think either Jesus did die on a cross and rise again, or he didn't. There's no way it can be true for me that he died and rose, but not true for you. It's either true or false, and therefore one of us is either right or wrong.
Mm. Okay, you've defended the perspective, but now I need you to defend the book, because let's do a little bit of historicity and a little bit of authenticity. The Bible seems to be composed over thousands of years by multiple different authors. Not only that, there seems to be a big old pause between the Italian prophet Malachi, and the New Testament, and then all of a sudden the New Testament picks it up again with a whole bunch of different authors. It doesn't seem to be settled until much later. How can we at all, in any way, shape or form, trust the Bible?
Well, I think one of the clues to why we can trust the Bible is actually contained in your question. It's astonishing that over a millennium, multiple authors in diverse historical settings, in different languages, have in the end told a remarkably unified story. Mm. Anyone who patiently tries to understand the Bible from Genesis to Revelation will perhaps get the impression that this was beautifully composed, so that the beginning corresponds to the end, that the middle part is the pivot point and all this. You'd think that it was sort of micromanaged because it hangs together so beautifully, but we know it wasn't. We know that there's a vast array of collected documents from different periods of different authors, but it tells a remarkably unified story. That's one clue. The other clue is historical evidence. There's actually pretty good historical evidence. Not for everything, but we don't have historical evidence for many things from the ancient world, but we do have good historical evidence for stuff like King David You know, people used to doubt that King David existed, that he was just invented in the Bible. And then they found an inscription that mentioned the house of David, and it was a bit of an oops moment in scholarship. You think of Jesus, you know, there are people walking around thinking that Jesus is just a myth, you know, just like Santa Claus or something out of Middle Earth. But we know beyond doubting it's actually something around the Middle East. And Jesus is reported not only in the Christian documents and in non-Christian documents. So the history, I think, is pretty strong. And the third reason I'd say the Bible is trustworthy is that it explains the world. The more you put on these glasses of the Bible, the Bible's view of the world, the more it actually clarifies everything in our world. C.S. Lewis said that he believes in Christianity like he believes in the sun in the sky, not just because he can see the sun, but because the sun lights up everything else for him to see. And I think the Bible is a bit like that. It lights up the world, and so it confirms itself. And then, of course, you know, if you read the Bible and you put it into practice, it changes you. This book is, it's like it's alive. Mm. It's not just a thing in your head, it's a thing in your life. And so, you know, in the end, I read my Bible, and I really, I think there are good reasons to trust it. And when I do, I find it transforming me to be less of a jerk.
Okay. Follow-up question. It seems, given modern cultural context, that the Bible is particularly outdated, especially on the subject of relationships and marriage, and Christians seem to fire up with all these old-timey debates. And not only that, within the Christian rank, we don't seem to agree on it. Some are for it, some are against marriage equality. There's a broad spectrum, but why do you hate love? Why do you hate marriage, coming from Scripture?
I think first thing is the Scripture makes perfectly clear that we should be able to have a civil conversation around these difficult topics. That, however, whatever view we come to, whatever view our world comes to, we can walk in this world and speak in this world with generosity of spirit and holding our convictions, but with compassion. Conviction and compassion seems to be the way Jesus did it. And Jesus was, you know, full of conviction. I mean, his views on marriage are the traditional views, actually the same views that the Romans had, the Greeks had. His view was clearly that marriage is a man and a woman. But he held that with such compassion, so that when he met a woman who'd committed adultery, for example, who had sort of broken that marriage bond, he, on the one hand, asked her to leave her life of sin. On the other, he said, "I don't condemn you," and offered her forgiveness. And I think it's a pretty good model, not just for issues of marriage, but for every topic, for a Christian to think about Jesus having deep convictions about what is real and deep compassion for those who disagree. And I think if you move in the world with those two things, don't give up your biblical convictions, but hold them with compassion, I think we have a recipe for getting on in the world and being a blessing to the world instead of you know, shouting the world down or seeming to be a negative influence in the world.
Okay, I'm going to be a little bit fatalistic here right now. If God knows everything, like he seems to suggest, and not only that, he seems to have it all worked out, then what's the point in praying or talking to him at all?
Well, if you come into a relationship with someone, it's pretty weird to sort of not talk to them, right? So that's the first thing I'd say. You know, it doesn't matter how powerful they are. You know, if you've come to know them, and you know they love you, and you love them, it would be the weirdest thing in the world to say, "Oh, well, I've got everything in control. I'm not going to bring my concerns to them." So that's the first thing I'd say. But the second is, I love the insight of Blaise Pascal, that 17th century French mathematician and philosopher, and he was asked this question, you know, what's the point of prayer? And he said something to the effect of, God invites us to pray because he wants his creatures, us, to have the dignity of causality, by which he meant allowing us to participate in the unfolding work of God. So God doesn't just decree things and they happen. Part of his governance of the world is to allow his children to ask him to do things, and he, in prayer, gives us the dignity of being the reason he does things in the world in response to our prayers. Yes, God is ultimately in control, but that doesn't mean we don't have a real effective role in the world to participating in the will of God by asking him to do stuff. And it is his delight to do things in the world in response to our prayers.
Yeah. Okay. One of the questions probably that you answer in your book, Doubter's Guide to Ten Commandments, is I often get the idea, listen, the Ten Commandments are a great way to live your life by, but the rest of God I don't need. And I kind of think to myself, man, the Ten Commandments are a great way to live your life by, but no one's achievably been able to do that. And I feel like that pushes us to a relationship with God. How would you answer a person who says, Ten Commandments are a great way, but I don't need God?
I'd turn them over to you, because what you just said is exactly the thing I'd say. I'd say, look, you know, sure, the Ten Commandments are great. When you look at them, they're so wise. Mm. Every area of life is covered. It's about, you know, it's partly about acknowledging your Creator and partly about caring for other creatures. Okay, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. But you get to the end and you go, I can't do this. I mean, you know, the 10th commandment, do not covet, right? Mm. You know, I've done that 5 times by the time I get to work in the morning.
Yeah.
So the thing is, as beautiful as these commandments are, we don't follow them, certainly not perfectly. And so every culture through history has tried to work out, how does one atone for our mistakes? How does one bridge the gap between what we know is right and how we actually live? And so, you know, lots of religions have developed with all sorts of, you know, sacrificial systems or good work systems to outdo your bad deeds by doing more good deeds and so on. But Christianity's answer is clear, beautiful, and unique. It says, you can't fulfill these commandments. You can't make up for your failure to fulfill these commandments. But Christ entered the world. He lived the life, the perfect life none of us could live. He gave that life on a cross, on our behalf, so we could be forgiven for all of our failure. And his goodness is transferred to us because he's the one who gave his life and rose again so that we could be right with God. And so this, you know, the gospel at the heart of Christianity is the ultimate answer to this objection that you bring forward.
Mm, brilliant. I guess on that note, we should say we'll see you all in church on Sunday at Roseville, because a great stuff, John. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, man.
It's always great to talk to you guys. Thanks so much.